This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
A week into the job, new Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason says he's not the type to mince words.
I think being transparent, being open and honest, maybe to a fault, it's a benefit.
Gleason talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about economic development, downtown, and his many roles in law enforcement. Plus, basketball at the Coliseum was once considered an important part of the event mix for the Bloomington facility. Where is it now? Eric Stock reports. And a football coach leaves a big school program over faith-based considerations in Bloomington Normal. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A week into the job, Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason is settling into his new position at City Hall. He's still getting through his one-on-one meetings with elected officials and department heads. GLT's Ryan Denham visited Gleason's office at City Hall to find out what the former Decatur City Manager is hearing so far.
It's a strong desire to increase economic development for the community. Strong desire to partner with, the different governmental entities, McLean County and Normal, the town of, and also to address some of the challenges that we know that we have. Infrastructure is a biggie here. What I would call the common things that most Illinois municipalities are dealing with. The one thing that I think Bloomington is different is the opportunities or the solutions, I think, might be a little bit easier. I don't want to say that they will be easier, but a little bit more solutions than what some of the other cities in the state are faced with.
You started several new jobs over the last 8 years or so, worked for the state of Illinois, CEO of Correctional Industries, Deputy Director of the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, City Manager of Washington and Decatur, and now Bloomington. So what have you learned about that process of becoming a leader in a new place, but doing so without stepping on too many landmines as you get settled into the new job?
Sure. I think the biggest thing, and it's not so much, you can't read it in a textbook, but it's just smart to assess. You step in to a new position, understand your surroundings first. Sometimes, and I've been in positions in the past where day one I've had to address certain things, immediately. But that's not the case here, at least so far. Appreciate the opportunity. Things seem to be going rather smoothly, which does not suggest that we can't improve on things. But I think it's going to allow me to sit back and assess for a while before we dive into changes, if any.
You've got around 630 full-time employees in Bloomington, including about a dozen on your executive staff. So how do you evaluate that team, especially those leaders, those executive-level leaders? How do you determine who's a good fit as you're making these assessments?
The meetings, whether it's collectively or individually. And the second week, I'm starting the one-on-one meetings with the department directors, a formal meeting. I've had a fair amount of interaction with most, and at least as a group with all of them. But again, you check out the resume, you pick up on the sense of what other employees and their peers have of that department head. And I think I've stepped into a good situation.
You said in other interviews that one of your strengths is that you're very open and honest. Can you describe that as a strength and how that comes into play as you're taking over this new role?
I think when you're in government, it's one where you've got public mistrust or maybe skepticism. from the public. You know, we are stewards of the taxpayer dollars. And I think being transparent, being open and honest, you know, maybe to a fault when we're talking about any government issues, it's a benefit. I think a lot of times, whether you're dealing with a union, whether you're dealing with an individual employee, or the elected officials or the community, if we lay all of our cards, if you will, out on the table, you know, might put you in a position or in the crosshairs for some criticism, but I really think, you know, the truth will set you free and, you know, the high road prevails, I guess, has been my philosophy.
Well, city officials, including the mayor himself, have expressed frustration at times with the pace at which economic development efforts move in Bloomington. I want to ask if that's something that you've heard in one-on-ones with aldermen and other folks you've met with in the first few weeks on the job.
It is. It is something that I've heard even prior to starting day one last Monday. I had a few people from the community reach out to me and express some concerns. You know, the pace at which we achieve, let's say, wins in economic development, there's always a rest of the story. You swing and miss when you're trying to pursue new opportunities more than you actually connect. You know, before I say that something is, you know, remiss on the economic development front, I need to learn a little bit more. But to answer your question, yes, I have heard those concerns.
Based on what you have learned so far, do you sense that there's a need for additional resources, be it staff or otherwise, to help on economic development initiatives?
I think the best way that I would answer that, Ryan, is at this point, this early in the game, and it's not one that I can wait too long. I mean, this is a critical topic for us at the city. But I would say it this way. I've got more questions, and I actually have a meeting with Bob Mart on Thursday morning. So before I you know, say that I have concerns or think that we're thin on resources, I've got questions first that I'd like to get answered.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Tim Gleason, the new city manager for Bloomington. He's 1 week into the job. So downtown is a core priority for the city council, very much intertwined with what we've been talking about with economic development. There are concerns, though, that downtown has stalled a bit and is withering even a little. And I, you know, with a few exceptions, Farmers Market is one, some businesses, but still a lot of vacancies and not a lot of big swings from the city downtown in the wake of the arena. So how much of your attention will downtown receive in this first year on the job, and where do you even begin?
Actually, you're going to see us bring the some of the downtown discussions back in front of council next month at one of the council meetings. Might be the committee of the whole meeting, but we're going to discuss with council members in the plan that I reviewed what possibilities and what opportunities do we have to address yet this year.
Well, Grossinger Motors Arena is a key part of that downtown, but it's had a very rocky first decade or so since it opened. It's on the second management company now, more stable than the first, but is still losing a significant amount of money. You've said in other interviews that the arena is one where you still need to get a little bit deeper into the details before you feel comfortable addressing it fully. But in your one-on-ones with elected officials, was it a concern? Is there discomfort with the status quo over there? Or is that, you know, pretty far down on your priority list at this point?
No. It actually, I'm not going to say it's at the top, but it's an area of concern. You mentioned the status quo. None of the elected officials are happy with where we currently stand. Really, the thing that I need to do is understand, you know, what are the other opportunities? You know, what is that one key component that potentially is going to turn this thing around? I know some people have talked about a hotel. And then when we have the hotel discussion, how much by way of incentives to attract a developer that would even consider building a hotel. I mean, there is a big discussion that needs to occur when we're talking about hotels specifically. and then even is a hotel, you know, that key link to trying to make the arena a viable, you know, downtown attraction. So a lot of questions attached to that as well.
Well, folks, may be familiar somewhat with the Decatur Civic Center. Is that what it's still called?
Yeah.
What was how did that place operate? What was sort of the oversight model there as it related to the city of Decatur?
Actually, City Hall is in the Civic Center. And the arrangement, it's a 99-year lease. It began in 1980. That basically the city of Decatur subsidizes any losses, if you will, to the Civic Center. So the staff there, they do their best. But I think we're at a current subsidy of about $450,000, and it's held that for the last handful of years. But it's tough trying to attract, you know, bigger name acts. The venue is pretty full down there, but it's just not your larger acts.
Let's talk infrastructure next, specifically roads. In Decatur, during your tenure, City Council approved a new local motor fuel tax to pay for road work. In Bloomington, there's been a reluctance, at least with this council, to raise taxes in certain cases, although there has been some exceptions, fees, garbage collection fees, sewer fees most recently. Can you talk about how you and the Decatur Council reached that agreement on the local motor fuel tax and what your overall philosophy is on when it is time to go back to taxpayers on something like that?
I think with the Decatur-specific discussion, that would have been in April of 2016, that this was implemented. I knew that there had been that discussion in the past, and I resurrected it with the council members, and they eventually approved it. But we had none, no motor fuel tax. But what we did, and we've done this with other taxes, where it was pledged specifically with a sunset provision at 10 years on the local motor fuel tax. And it was a local roads worst first type of approach. Unless there was an economic development opportunity, we would use the funds for that. And we're generating about $1.9 million a year, nickel on the unleaded and a penny on diesel. So the approach was, being very public in communicating and actually putting it in the ordinance. This is for residential roads. And did not want the community to think that this was going to get lost in the general fund. So we took that approach, and it's actually been very successful.
And you haven't been a City Hall guy your whole career. You worked for a Pekin Police Department from 1989 to 2010, retiring as a lieutenant. My understanding is you're going to continue to teach criminal justice courses at the University of Illinois at Springfield, even as you take this job in Bloomington. So why is that so important to you? What do you enjoy about doing that?
Well, I actually started that when I was still a police officer in 2008. And I just enjoy the interaction with the students. Majority of the students are younger, your traditional age group. And the two classes that I teach, I created a class, Community Policing, and that's one that I teach on campus, and then the other one is Criminal Investigation. And the university has approached me and asked if I'd be willing to change over to management or public administration, and I am interested in that, but have filled an area that would be a void if I wasn't continuing to teach a criminal justice stuff for UIS.
So how do you think your experience as a former police officer informs your approach to supervising a police chief, overseeing their budgets, contract negotiations with their unions, those types of issues?
I think I'm going to answer this more generically and say that anybody that comes up through the ranks of public safety, I think it's a perfect transition into city management. And you continue to deal with problems. You continue to have to take in and digest multiple sides to any given topic. And sometimes you have to be prepared to make a quick decision. And sometimes you're able to take your time and make the decision a little bit down the road. So through ICMA, which is the International City and County Management Association, very much I'm an advocate that police officers, fire officers, at least consider the city management, as a possibility in their career.
But I also want to ask, I mean, do you find yourself either in Washington or in Decatur, or do you find yourself paying a special amount of attention to a police department just because you have that background? Or do you kind of go the other direction with it and you say, well, you know, I feel like I have a handle on that, so maybe I'm focusing my learning energy elsewhere.
No, I think it's an assessment of my department directors. And you give more attention where you feel attention is deserved. You've got Clay Wheeler, that's a new police chief, but this guy sounds solid. And the meetings that I've had with him, I'm very impressed. He is a 28-year veteran of the police department, came up through the ranks. I think it's a great pick. Brian Moore on the fire side, somebody that actually a lot of fire chiefs and connections that I have around the state, this guy is thought very highly of. So on the public safety side and other areas, but we're talking about public safety, I think the city is in very good hands.
Well, while in Decatur, you were part of a well-documented run-in with the former police chief there, Brad Sweeney. He was fired, and after a kind of a legal fight, he ended up retiring instead, paying some money to the city in legal fees. How do you think people here in Bloomington should view that incident and how it reflects on your leadership style and how you may handle executive members of your team?
I think that they should feel confident that department directors are going to be held accountable. Also, before that, they're equipped with the proper tools and training to be able to successfully complete the job. I mean, without going into details, that totally was not the case in that dismissal at all. It was a three-week period that's well documented. In that case, I mean, we ended up arguing repeatedly, one at the circuit level, twice at the appellate level. We're arguing the legality of the whistleblower claim by the former police chief, and we never got to the truth of the matter, where I was able to call in witnesses to the conduct. So we really tried to package at the end of all of it a settlement statement that really said it all, if people care to take the time to read it. I think it sums up everything.
Well, Bloomington has a one-year-old Public Safety and Community Relations Board. It was sought in the wake of violence and unrest between communities and police departments across the country. The board chair of the Bloomington PSCRB, as it's called, says he hopes it'll inoculate us against similar unrest. What do you think of that board and what you've heard about it so far, given your background in community policing? And how hopeful are you that something like it can keep Bloomington from a worse situation?
I think it sounds as if it's very similar to a group that I was part of the creation of, and the acronym was ALERTS, the minority community being engaged in day-to-day issues and challenges and problems. And, the day that something, God forbid, happens where, you've got a minority-involved victim, let's say a white male police officer, you get them, you activate them. And we've done that twice in Decatur since the creation of that. And what's interesting is if members of the community remember the officer-involved shooting in Minneapolis where the girlfriend videotaped her boyfriend, dying in the front seat of the car. And then you had the first of, I think, two Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and then not even a full week later, we had an officer-involved shooting. National media shows up, and credit to, obviously, the police department indicator, but the alerts team standing up and saying, we trust our police department. We trust that this is going to be given a fair look in the investigation and really turn things around. It didn't make the national media like it could have, because it definitely was a very volatile time. And to your question specifically, about the program in Bloomington, it sounds very similar. So I'm anxious to learn more.
That's new Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham. Gleason is 1 week into the new job.
Support for GLT comes from the Garlic Press, celebrating everything sweet with their popcorn and candy shop. Freshly popped corn in 40 flavors, homemade fudge, vintage candies from your childhood, and artisan chocolates await. Open until 9 p.m. all summer long at 108 North Street in Uptown Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, hemp. It's not just for medical conditions. It's been 3 years since Bloomington's Grossinger Motors Arena hosted basketball. Director Lynn Cannon tells GLT's Eric Stock the venue is working with a professional league in hopes of bringing the sport back to the venue as just one way to help fill some of the open dates on the calendar.
Yes, we would love to have basketball here. We certainly, you know, have the facility for it. We have a great basketball court. We've got all the equipment. So, yeah, we are definitely looking forward to being able to host some more basketball here.
Now, the last time it was here, I believe it was the State Farm Holiday Classic in 2015 high school shootout that happens in late December. And there have been high school regionals, sectionals that have been here in the past. Has the arena submitted bids for any of those kinds of events?
We haven't submitted bids for any of those kinds of events yet, but we are working with the CVB and trying to look at our ability and timing-wise with our schedule when we can look at some of those future events.
Are there scheduling issues that would make that difficult?
Well, we do have, you know, 30 hockey games here every year, which we don't always get that schedule until midsummer. So sometimes when we're looking ahead, we want to make sure that we have those dates filled, and then we try to work around those. But the hockey schedule, you know, comes out every year, and if we do put some event on the calendar far enough in advance, then they simply wouldn't ask for that date. So we can work around that as well.
Now, the Bloomington Flex, and before that they were known as the Central Illinois Drive, they were here for just a couple of years. They struggled to bring in a lot of fans, apparently not enough to stay in business. Now, that was before Venue Works' time. But what would lead you to believe that maybe another team that could come here would have better success?
Well, I think advertising is the key to any type of event that we have here in our building, and I think that with the right person and the right group leading the charge and letting people know that the events are happening here, we certainly could be very, very well off as far as attendance is concerned. We look forward to hosting events that are very well advertised in the public so that people are aware. I think basketball is huge in this community. You can look at the Illinois State Games and just know that there are thousands of people that attend basketball games. We should not have a problem drawing fans here.
Now, I know you have the football team in the Edge and the hockey team in the Flying Aces, and those are sports that are unique to this area. No one else really provides that, but you can find basketball almost anywhere, the colleges, the high schools, even at the youth level, boys and girls. Is there too much basketball already for you to find your niche?
I don't know. I think if you're looking to see a professional basketball game, it's a little bit different than what is also available here in this community, and I think that that would be a draw. I think that those organizations would be interested in seeing that next level and that we would potentially have a great fan base already built in.
Now, you have a court here that you inherited, I suppose, from Central Illinois Arena Management that came before your arrival here, I guess, right?
Yes, we have the court that was here originally, yes.
And was refinished recently. How much cost is that to upkeep, to basically have in storage at this point?
Well, we have it in storage, but we do use it for other events. We have other events that utilize that court, especially the Illinois State High School Association, their dance and cheer finals that are here every year. We put the floor out. So it's not sitting in storage for 100% of the time. It is certainly available, and we would love to utilize it more than we currently do, but I have no problem letting you know that it's in great shape.
The Grossinger Motors Arena website, looking at it a couple of days ago, there are four upcoming events on the calendar. One of them is a Back to School Alliance school supply giveaway. I guess not maybe a huge moneymaker. And that doesn't include Flying Aces hockey. But are you satisfied with how many events there are at this point?
We actually have several events that are booked we just haven't announced yet. So this is our season to be booking. And right now in late summer and early fall are when many of the tours for the late fall and winter take place. So we have events that will be announced very soon, and we will be filling the dates around the Flying Aces calendar that we just recently received.
Are there other events in the offing that are sort of in the works that will help bring more people other than the ones that you're sort of alluding to?
You know, one of the things that we're going to be doing is a really great New Year's Eve concert, that something new and different to town. I think it'll be very exciting, and I think we'll draw a really big crowd of a lot of fun, festive New Year's Eve goers. We were looking at doing something around Halloween as well. Hopefully we'll be able to pull that together. And for sure we're going to have our second annual Beer and Bacon Festival. That went over very well last year, and we're going to be expanding on that and moving some of those distributors up to the concourse level, so we'll have more room for people to be able to experience those craft brews and bacon specialties for the surrounding restaurants.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stonk with Lynn Cannon, director of Grossinger Motors Arena. And to discuss city business for just a minute, the city council last week had approved installing a new elevator here at the arena to meet requirements for the Americans with Disabilities Act. This was based on an edict that came from the state attorney general's office. Now, those issues, it appears, were first discovered in 2016 at the time that Venue Works was just taking over. Was this something that Venue Works was involved in its discovery?
No, I don't believe it was something that Venue Works had anything to do with. I think that was something that had happened prior to our being here with a consumer complaint to the attorney general's office. The city took the information and then moved forward on making the reparations that needed to be made so that everybody is completely in compliance with the ADA.
It's a venue that you inherited. This was designed like this when it was opened over a decade ago. So were you thinking what happened at the very beginning?
Personally, yes, you would think that this would have been something that would have been addressed in the original construction, but since I wasn't here then and I don't actually know the, you know, designs and planning and what was done, I couldn't really speak to that.
Now, the city council voted 5-3 to buy the elevator, so they came pretty close to possibly killing that deal with only 5 months left to make adjustments to avoid being in violation. And several council members had recommended other provisions that they imagined might cost less. Those were generally shot down. If the council had voted against this and they came close to doing that, were you prepared to go another option to meet those requirements by the end of the year?
I think that the facilities department at the city looked pretty carefully at all of the options and worked with the attorney general's office to find the solution that would not only be the best for the building, but also that would be in compliance with the law. And I think that they knew fairly early on that this was the only option that was available to us. I think the discussion certainly was at city council level to make sure that those searches had taken place and that all of the proper investigations were done. But I think that, you know, at the end of the day, if we hadn't been in compliance with the ADA, the building would not be able to operate.
So Bloomington's new city manager has been on the job for a week, Tim Gleason. I understand you just had your first meeting with him. You've been here since December of 2016. How would you describe yours and Venue Works' relationship with the city?
Our relationship with the city is very good. I think we have great interaction with them. We're working very closely with them in all departments. I think that we do, you know, multiple meetings every month so that we're in compliance with everything that they've asked us to do. I just met Tim Gleason for the first time this morning. He's a very cordial gentleman, and I look forward to showing him the arena and all the opportunities that we have here.
Now, it's been almost a year since the news came out about the former managers here under Central Illinois Arena Management in this criminal indictment. How does the arena's history and its baggage, so to speak, still weigh on the day-to-day work now in a business where reputation is so critical?
I think one of the best things that the city did was to bring in a reputable company like Venue Works, who does business in many other arenas and theaters around the Midwest. So the promoters and the people that we do business with are very comfortable in bringing their shows to our buildings.
And there's no questions that you get about that in the past?
I don't get those questions, no. So I appreciate the fact that people understand that it wasn't our company that had anything to do with that, and the fact that as we've moved forward, the city gets most of those questions directed to them, and I certainly direct the questions that way because that was something before my time.
Now, every 3 months, we look at the arena's quarterly finances, and that could be challenging to compare current performance to past performance because of this criminal case and allegations that the numbers were made up. How does the public judge whether the arena is being run successfully?
I think the judge of the arena's success is in the economic impact. I think that when we look at the events that we bring into the city and where the people come from to attend our events, you can see that people are coming to Bloomington specifically to attend events here in the arena. They're staying in our hotels, they're eating at our restaurants, and they're enjoying more than one day in many events, especially with the IHSA finals that we have here. Those are entire weekends. The Central Illinois Flying Aces brought about 150 kids from all over the world here in June for their Flying Aces tryout camp, and the parents that came with those kids that came to that camp enjoyed this community immensely. It was a really great event. So we continue to look for ways to bring longer term events here. Some other tournaments we're looking at and looking ahead to is perhaps an esports tournament early next year. So we're going to be continuing to look for ways to bring more people to our community.
Has the arena found its niche, so to speak? There seemed to be a time where country music acts were doing really well, and maybe there aren't as many as there used to be, but do you feel that there was a certain niche that this arena could plug into?
Well, I know country music does well in this arena. That we have proven over and over again, and even the past history shows that. We had branched out a little bit last year, tried some other acts. We're looking ahead to looking at some additional acts, maybe a little bit more urban, maybe a little more cutting edge. We want to bring to town things that the people of Bloomington and Normal want to see. So that's what we're looking at in our upcoming calendar.
The arena has also posted a lot of that information, contracts, et cetera, online to give the public a sense for how much you're making, how much you're paying out for these events. And that transparency, I think, was welcomed by many in light of what had happened in the past. Does that hamstring you in any way in terms of showing your hand to potential promoters who now know what they can ask for?
We try not to let it hamstring us in any way at all. It doesn't become a part of the negotiations. We certainly, we know what it costs to do business in this building. We know what our expenses are, and we're pretty upfront with the promoters and letting them know that. And we're partners with them in most cases. We are sharing in all of the revenue so that we can make those promoters and shows. We all want to make money, and we don't want to lose money, so we look at the pros and the cons, and I'll be honest, sometimes we have to pass on a show because we can't find a way to make it work.
You obviously want events, but you don't want events that are going to cost you money.
That's the key, is how much will it cost and is it worth the cost? You can assume you're going to sell so many tickets based on past performance, and we do a lot of risk assessment to make sure that when we're looking at these shows that we're looking at their past performance in cities such as ours. And, of course, with the VenueWorks network of families, we have a lot of people and colleagues that we can call on and ask how did it go, what did you do, how did you make your event successful? So we do what we can to make it the most successful that it can be. You don't hit a home run every time, but we hope to get a lot of base hits.
Grossinger Motors Arena Director Lynn Cannon talking with GLT's Eric Stock. Cannon did not disclose the basketball league the arena is working with, but says the goal is for the team to play in the late winter through summer.
feet up Mount Everest, the deadliest storm in the mountain's history, was about to hit.
The teams had doctors, but only at base camp. They didn't have doctors high up on the mountain. I was the only doctor within reach.
And the only doctor who could respond to a crisis.
You really never know how you're going to respond to a crisis until that time happens.
Crisis and response, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care. Heritage has been offering specialized healthcare services to seniors in Bloomington Normal for more than 50 years. On the web at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. Coming up, a coach makes a faith-based decision to leave the big job, Eric Stock reports. A new crop could soon cycle through Illinois' agriculture rotation, industrial hemp. But as Jacqueline Driscoll reports for Illinois Issues, it's not really all that new at all.
Hemp has been used for centuries to make rope, fishnets, paper, car parts, fuel, and more. It's an unruly crop. It's skinny, it's tall. But what has made it controversial is that it's a derivative of the cannabis plant.
You could smoke an acre of it, and all you would get would be a headache.
That's Betty Obendorf, the historian in the tiny Illinois town of Polo, where farmers grew industrial hemp during World War II. She says it's been considered one of the most valuable commodities for years.
Hemp was brought over from the other countries, and they only brought their most valuable things.
And it was valuable to farmers in Illinois. In Polo alone, farmers produced more than 10,000 tons of hemp straw just in the 1943 season, and hemp brought in an average of $93 per acre. Soon after the war ended, Congress passed harsher penalties for drug offenses, including cannabis, and in 1970, the Controlled Substance Act was passed. This made cannabis a Schedule I drug, the most restrictive category. That included hemp. However, language included in the 2014 Farm Bill allowed states to begin growing hemp for research purposes. Today, at least 35 states have passed legislation related to hemp, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. For years, Illinois has tried to pass legislation that would allow farmers to grow industrial hemp. But the stigma associated with hemp and marijuana has been the challenge. Even today, the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police opposes legislation that passed the General Assembly with overwhelming support to allow farmers to grow the crop. Ed Wojcicki is the group's executive director.
We're opposed to the legalization of recreational marijuana. We just see this bill as creeping into that issue. We decided we're taking a firm position against any bills that would move the needle toward legalization of marijuana.
Those concerns have been enough to offset the push from agricultural organizations like the Illinois Farm Bureau. They want to see hemp back in the state's fields, and usually what the ag industry wants carries a lot of weight in state government. This push has taken decades, but it might finally be nearing a finish line. Bill Bodine with the Illinois Farm Bureau says educating the public about what the plant actually is has been an important step.
It's a very low THC content plant. It's not intoxicating. And there was education that's been going on for years to make people understand that this is not marijuana. It's a different variety of a plant that does not have the intoxicating capabilities that marijuana has.
THC is the mind-altering component in marijuana. The industrial hemp that could possibly grow in Illinois would have extremely low levels and would be tested by the Department of Agriculture regularly. Bodine says this could be a viable option for farmers.
In the last few years, the economics have been difficult for corn and soybean production. There may be an interest in growing, a different crop that might present a different opportunity, a different, income stream for them.
Market prices for corn, soybeans, and wheat are low. On average, producing a bushel of corn will cost more than a farmer can make from it. Mike Doherty is a senior economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau.
Input costs have come down. There has been some market adjustment because of the low crop prices, but they haven't come down nearly as much as the crop prices have.
Doherty says predicting the market size potential for industrial hemp is difficult since it's been illegal for so long, but he has no doubt it would benefit farmers in Illinois. Aside from the possible agricultural benefits, Rebecca Oslin with the Illinois Stewardship Alliance also says it could help the environment.
From a soil health perspective, we'd really like to see a lot more diversity in what farmers are able to grow profitably. And the way that hemp grows, there's really a low need for chemical inputs.
Most recently, the United States Senate included language in its version of a farm bill that would allow hemp to be sold as an agricultural commodity and allow states to regulate their programs. The legislation passed this spring in Illinois will soon head to Governor Bruce Rauner's desk, though he has given no indication as to whether he will sign it or not. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
And you're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Faith and football have often been linked in American culture, but for a man of faith coaching at a public school, Joe Walters had to walk a tightrope while coaching at Bloomington High School. Walters talks with GLT's Eric Stock about his decision to leave BHS and how he landed at Central Catholic as its new head football coach after serving on the boys' basketball staff under Jason Welch.
Coach Welch had called me a couple times a year before, and then he called me this last year, and he asked if I would be interested in doing some of the faith-based stuff with his guys and filling a role as an assistant. Of course, I didn't know much about basketball, but I figured, well, this is a good opportunity because I was feeling like it would be a great thing to do. So I took the job, and then as time went on, I think there was a bit of a conflict at Bloomington and then being at Central. So, you know, talking it through with Mr. Moore and decided to be best to just to focus on Central Catholic and the basketball side and the faith side. So I did that, and I felt pretty good about it. I had no idea I was going to be a head football coach again and wasn't even sure I'd be an assistant because I had no job at the time. And Mike called me, Mike Mays, in, I don't know, we talked January, maybe February. And
he was the head coach of Central Catholic at the time for the football program.
Yep, and I know him well through his insurance agency and just obviously coaching fraternity. And he knew that I was in the area, you know, that I would be at the school. So we worked it out where I could assist him. And then obviously when he left, that opened up the door to be the head coach.
But going back to when you were at Bloomington and you had taken the job at the basketball program at Central Catholic, prior to that, was there a particular instance or scenario where you realized that your desire to be in a faith-based setting wasn't compatible with what you were chartered to do at a public school in Bloomington?
Yeah, I guess so in my first year at Bloomington, we did just a ton of stuff. And, you know, you always have the right to live out your faith, really, in our country, but you can't force that on other people.
So what do you mean by ton of stuff?
Well, as far as living out your faith?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, as Herschel Hanna, the associate superintendent, when we went through the whole process, he said, it's okay to be a faith-based person here at our school. It's okay to live out your faith. It's just not okay to force that on the kids, obviously, which, that's pretty much common sense. So that when I took the job, I knew that going in, so I wanted to make sure that was going to work well for me and what I wanted to do. So it didn't work as well as I wanted it to because I wanted to do a lot more, but I have to work within the rules of our district here, and, we don't want to cause any undue stress for the school or the kids or, the taxpayers. So I focused on letting the kids do what they wanted to do, allowing them to do what they felt they were called to do. And then I, first year, did a little bit, probably too much. Second year, backed off and just let them, go with it. And they did. They, some were involved, some were not, and that was their choice.
As in student athletes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If some might go and pray after practice, some might not. And I had to stay kind of neutral about the whole thing, which is hard when you're a faith, when you're a Christian and you want to be, sometimes the solution to a kid's problem might be, the answer. You might have the answer, but you can't always share it with them in that setting. So that was tough. So prayed about it a lot.
Was there a particular moment in that scenario there where you thought this isn't quite what I want to do because of that limitation?
Yeah, I would say probably towards the end of the first season. I think it was gradual. Mm-hmm. you just kind of, it goes and it goes, and then you wake up one day and saying, man, I really miss that, and I'm not able to do it as much as I wanted. The parents, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion either way with them. I think they, I don't know how much they really, we tried not to make it a thing, so
sure.
I don't know how much they said or didn't say, or, nothing was ever, I wouldn't say anything was brought to my attention that I thought, nothing like that. But I did know that, some kids just have different faiths, or they don't have faith, or they believe, it's their right to do. And as a person in a leadership role with those kids, it's important, that you give them the ability to do what they believe.
But there was no direct pushback from students or parents or administrators or anything like that?
No, nothing. Nothing that stands out as, nothing. Mr. Moore is very good at running that high school, and Mr. Riley obviously is a great superintendent. And so they're very cautious. We talked a lot about it in the interview process. They explained very clearly, constitutional rights for me and for the students and for the other employees. So we knew, I knew where I stood going in, and then we constantly talked. Mr. Moore and I probably met every couple days throughout.
And Tim Moore, the Bloomington High School principal, mm-hmm. and Dr. Riley, the superintendent.
Yeah, and we would meet, I would say, every couple days during the season and the off season weekly. And then even Dr. Riley and I met many times with Mr. Moore and Herschel around. So, we were very cautious. I was trying to stay within the boundaries, and it was hard. I thought it'd be easier than it was, I guess, is the point.
And as we continue with the Sound Ideas, Eric Stock here with Central Catholic football coach Joe Walters. So how does your faith play a role in what you do as a football coach or a coach in general?
Yeah, so as a, you know, as a Christian, I have a strong belief in you know, where we all came from and where we're all going, and sometimes our problems are self-inflicted, but other times we just need that God's help and God's involvement in our life clears things up really well for us. So, and that's a belief of mine. And in coaching, there's a lot of stress in football specifically, but all sports. But in coaching football and playing football, you know, it's a very high level of competition. There's a lot of, there's a stressful environment. It's very physical. So you take that team atmosphere, then you take the competition, the competitive nature of the game, and then you add the physical nature, not just, you know, of running and blocking, but the physical side where you're being bruised and those things. And it takes that emotionally, it takes you emotionally to a whole new level. So for me, I feel like it's important to share, you know, what the Creator can do for those kids.
Well, you do hear more and more, and perhaps because football in more circles is coming under attack because of concerns about head injuries and that sort of thing. Numbers seem to be declining at the youth levels. More football coaches are saying that the game teaches a certain kind of discipline, perseverance, teamwork that really no other sport can truly duplicate. Do you believe that?
Oh, there's no doubt. No doubt in my mind. I mean, basketball, after coaching it now a little bit, is has a lot of similarities, but it doesn't have that physical piece. Sure, underneath the basket, it gets pretty physical. You know, if you watch our, like Tommy Nelson, those guys aren't there, razor elbows, and yes, but it's still very much different than the fatigue combined with the physical contact piece of it. There's really nothing like it. And if you've ever been around a football practice, you know, it's hours of this over and over, weeks. I think we practice 100 times a year, something ridiculous now in the summer with the new rules. So there's a lot of that you just can't duplicate. Maybe military type of training, but still the physical contact piece isn't even there in that.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Joe Walters, the new head football coach at Central Catholic High School in Bloomington. And you came on board just a couple of days ago. The season starts in less than a month. Training camp starts in less than 2 weeks. And you are essentially new to the program. How do you make that work by the end of August?
Yeah, well, it's the third time I've had to, you know, been in a situation where I was somewhat new. At Notre Dame, I was an assistant for a year, then the head coach. Here I was assistant for a year as well. So I know the guys a little bit and kind of where we were as a program. So I think if I wasn't there at all, this would be, I'm not sure that I could pull that off. But as a, you know, having some understanding of it, I feel like that gives me a foundation that will be very valuable as we move forward. So, you know, I'm filling the staff roles right now. I hope to have that done by the end of the week. I think I could have it done as early as tomorrow. And then we'll start meeting on Saturday, me and the coaches. The kids are still lifting each day right now, which is, you know, important to keep the normalcy. But it's a lot of work that I will have to put in myself and the rest of the assistants. But it makes it more gratifying too when you work like that and then you see the change in the kids' lives.
Well, despite Central Catholic's success in the football field, 15 straight playoff appearances, 4 state titles over their history, numbers are declining, and that is true for a lot of football programs across the state. Is that a concern for you coming into this, and what do you attribute that to?
Yeah, so it's a concern in general because you need a lot of players to field a team. It's a little different than the other sports in that sense as well. You know, it's probably related, obviously, to the concussion issue going on in the nation. For us, you know, reading studies and realizing most of the contact that happens in a football season happens on the practice field. We practice a couple hours a night, but we only play, you know, a little bit each week. So if we can mitigate the risk of concussions by the way we practice, then we can take away about 80% of that risk. So that's what I started doing at Notre Dame back probably in 2012 when this stuff got hot. You know, it's hard to remove all the risk during a game, obviously. But during practice, we are fully in control of those drills. And so it's a philosophy and a policy of mine is that we don't do things that give the kids inherent risk of concussion. And it's worked really well for us.
As you knock on doors to get kids to come out to play, mm-hmm. I suspect you're doing that or you will be doing that, especially at Central Catholic at a private school. Do you get concern from parents about what steps are being taken to make sure that their son is safe?
No, that's the interesting thing, because so, you know, as we talk about declining numbers around the state and look at it, you know, it's not a kid that's going to be a junior and then leaves because he's nervous about concussions. So I think the kids that aren't playing before freshman year. So we never see these guys. And so there's not the conversation of I'm leaving because of concussions. So it's very rare.
Do you foresee a day when football at the high school, the college, or even the pro level becomes something different than what it is now? There's eight-man football. It's starting to grow in some parts of the Midwest. There are some schools in Illinois that are sampling that, maybe a non-tackle flag football, something like that. Do you foresee that ever happening in the next, say, 15, 20 years or beyond?
Well, I think we're at a point where if there is some significant litigation that would change the game immediately, you know, without it, I think it will slowly change just in response to the outcry that we hear. So, you know, it could happen overnight if there was some type of significant change and we weren't able to obtain insurance anymore. Otherwise, I do think it will slowly. And I think that's our responsibility as adults and coaches, that we got to protect our players and our children. So if we're not doing that, well, then shame on us.
Central Catholic High School football coach Joe Walters talking with GLT's Eric Stock. Walters says he didn't play football growing up in Texas, but his faith did get him on the right path after he got into some trouble when he was young. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.